It's a split personality. That's the Scatolites with Split Personality. It's a clue of where we're going today, by the way. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Thursday, February the 7th. And at around 2:30 this afternoon, President Obama's targeted killing by drone policy will come in for close scrutiny as the person who now controls the clandestine program, John Brennan, the president's chief counterterrorism advisor, comes before the Senate Intelligence Committee to be vetted for confirmation as CIA director. You will want to pay close attention to questions from Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon, Mark Udall, a Democrat from Colorado, and Susan Collins, Republican from Maine. We'll be talking about drone warfare tomorrow, but today I want to start off this next leg of deconstructing Obama and the media. It's, you know, hand-in-glove operation starting today and starting with the gun control issue because it's really a very interesting thing that's developing that's more than gun control. So I thought we'd start right off with the subject of being invisible all over again. The president sounded really good. I mean, wonderful, lofty words, noble, carefully crafted words that we heard on Inauguration Day. Let's remind ourselves, shall we? Let's remind ourselves, shall we? Run the tape.
Today I say to you that the challenges we face are real. They are serious and they are many. They will not be met easily or in a short span of time. But know this, America, they will be met. On this day, we gather because we have chosen hope over fear, unity of purpose over conflict and discord. On this day, we come to proclaim an end to the petty grievances and false promises, the recriminations and worn-out dogmas that for far too long have strangled our politics. We remain a young nation, but in the words of Scripture, the time has come to set aside childish things. The time has come to reaffirm our enduring spirit, to choose our better history, to carry forward that precious gift, that noble idea passed on from generation to generation, the God-given promise that all are equal, all are free, and all deserve a chance to pursue their full measure of happiness. They saw America as bigger than the sum of our individual ambitions, greater than all the differences of birth or wealth or faction. This is the journey we continue today. We remain the most prosperous, powerful nation on earth. Our workers are no less productive than when this crisis began. Our minds are no less inventive, our goods and services no less needed than they were last week or last month or last year. Our capacity remains undiminished, but our time of standing pat, of protecting narrow interests and putting off unpleasant decisions, that time has surely passed. Starting today, we must pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin again the work of remaking America. Yeah. to all the other peoples and governments who are watching today, from the grandest capitals to the small village where my father was born. Know that America is a friend of each nation and every man, woman, and child who seeks a future of peace and dignity. And we are ready to lead once more. We will not apologize for our way of life, nor will we waver in its defense. And for those who seek to advance their aims by inducing terror and slaughtering innocents, we say to you now that our spirit is stronger and cannot be broken. You cannot outlast us, and we will defeat you. Of who we are and how far we have traveled. In the year of America's birth, in the coldest of months, a small band of patriots huddled by dying campfires on the shores of an icy river. The Capitol was abandoned. The enemy was advancing. The snow was stained with blood. At a moment when the outcome of our revolution was most in doubt, the father of our nation ordered these words be read to the people. Let it be told to the future world that in the depth of winter, when nothing but hope and virtue could survive, that the city and the country, alarmed at one common danger, came forth to meet it. America, in the face of our common dangers, in this winter of our hardship, let us remember these timeless words. With hope and virtue, let us brave once more the icy currents and endure what storms may come. Let it be said by our children's children that when we were tested, we refused to let this journey end, that we did not turn back, nor did we falter. And with eyes fixed on the horizon and God's grace upon us, we carried forth that great gift of freedom and delivered it safely to future generations. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
Oh, great, great, great. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful words. A very impressive speech, very well written, and all of that. And it is as it should be. You know, head of state on Inauguration Day should make an impressive speech. And certainly the president has at his disposal pretty good speech writers, and they delivered. So, you know, he sounded good. But the Obama that we are going to be talking about is really somebody we need to be paying attention to, because those wonderful words that we just heard are in direct contrast to the actions that we are seeing. And those actions are quite troubling because they suggest a disconnect between the lofty ideas and what he condemned. He said this: we should be beyond ambitions. It's all, in fact, I contend, it's all about ambitions. And those ambitions get played out in the issues of the day. And so when you take a look at what the issues are, every day that the news, they're covering news items, you know, galore. But they really tell a narrative about the ambitions that are not overtly expressed. And we're going to start today. I want to return to this. I had commented a bit about it before, the gun issue. There's so much to say about it, and it makes sense to me to revisit it and to line it up in the order of things, because we're going to be proceeding with this discussion for quite a couple more days. Leading up to Inauguration Day, Obama had already taken on a gunfight, pardon the pun, with the NRA and gun owner groups. He was responding to the call largely by white America. I want to make that real important. It's very, very clear, very important. To do something about gun violence in the aftermath of the mass killing of pupils and staff at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. He even deputized Vice President Joe Biden to consult with various interested parties and groups and to come up with a plan of action within a month. Well, you may recall that we saw that effort in play. We saw Joe Biden sitting down and talking to people, and we saw a marked absence of people of color at the table. And I did remark that right from the start, this was a discussion that white America was having with itself. And I wanted to explain that because if you've been following the logic, insofar as I have any of my thoughts, the issue about racism and how central it is to all the issues that we're discussing, even when we have a black president, a quote, progressive and liberal guy at the helm, his first job is to maintain the standing order. And so when we talk about, whether we talk about gun control, or we're talking about drones, or we're talking about trade, or we're talking about foreign policy, you must always remember what the initial thrust was for independence, to set up a country, but not for everybody. So that speech that we just heard, we know it's just talk. It isn't a country set up for everybody. Come on now. But we have to say these things, and we hear these things because it is what we want to believe, as opposed to what really is the truth. The president we just heard him say that he's against special interests. But of course he is governed by special interests. So we have to start pointing these things out. Words, just words. You know, you expect to hear that kind of lofty language on an occasion such as an inauguration. But you have to always square the actions against the words. And you always have to throw into the mix the standing order, which is, this is a country that was settled by an invading force who claimed it, dispossessed it of its original inhabitants, and proceeded to construct an artificial society that it maintains through law and order. Their law, their order. Everybody is dancing in one way or the other to that tune. So Biden is talking, and we're not seeing, and I'll be specific about it, I've talked about it this way, we're not seeing black people in the room. And why am I saying just black people? Because the issue of gun violence is especially important to many black communities that have been dealing with this problem for a long, 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 long time. And we finally get that Joe Biden delivers whatever it is, his document, his recommendation to the president, and the president signs off to much fanfare, lots of media coverage, his executive orders he's signing, and the camera pans the room, and there are no black people, really. There are one or two. But it's an almost all-white crowd witnessing this momentous event. The point here is this. Barack Obama's response is initiated by his sense of obligation to white America. His sense of duty is to white America. I make no mistake. I'm not suggesting that we should not feel compassion for anybody or any group or any city or town that experiences this level of sorrow and tragedy. I'm talking now about politics. He took his orders and he made it clear because he had all this time, this issue of gun violence has been plaguing the African-American community for decades. And he, more than anybody ought to know, because he comes from Chicago, where the murder rate is out of control. He should have known that when he was a state representative there, a state senator. He certainly should have known that when he became a U.S. senator. So this particular issue should have had specific importance to him in terms of what he could do at the same time that he's responding to this particular situation in Newtown, what he could do to marry the interests also of a really hurting community. He doesn't do that. The press, you see, also approved of Obama's response to white America. They're white Americans for the most part. The newsrooms of America have remained remarkably devoid of melanin. So they're talking about themselves, about issues that concern them. And in one fell swoop, this is what I want us to understand. In one fell swoop, between Barack Obama's impulses to respond to his preferred constituency and the media's decision that this was of urgent attention needed, they both agreed to invent a reality that simply did not exist before. And that is that there are two kinds of gun violence now. There's urban gun violence and there's suburban gun violence. And because of this newfangled cleavage that they've created it. Gun violence in Chicago is just a bunch of black folks shooting and killing other black folks. It's black on black crime. It's genetically ordained. It is simply black folks acting out their violence on each other. Suburban gun violence is a course of a different color. It is about people becoming disaffected and unhinged from their reality and acting out because they need support. It is not white on white crime as opposed to the black on black crime. It is, in fact, it's consistent with Barack Obama's attention to that group that he insists are the group that all Americans should pay attention to, which is the middle class. So even in violence, he construes violence now to have a class aspect to it. And this president has ushered into our nomenclature two different realities about the same issue. It's like cancer. Now, you would think, and I would think, that cancer is cancer. But because there is so much money associated with cancer, money in terms of raising money for this kind of cancer, that kind of cancer, they'll have you believe that breast cancer is different from prostate cancer, which is different from esophageal cancer, which is different from skin cancer, which is different from any other kind of cancer. It's cancer. Because it lodges itself or occurs in a particular part of the body, does it change the nature of the disease? You wouldn't know that, but in the United States, it actually is that way. Or it's like for blacks, when blacks get sickle cell, it's called sickle cell. When whites get sickle cell, it's called lupus. It's bizarre. When white professionals have a professional organization, it's the American so-and-so, the American Association of Dentists. And when you hear the National Association of Dentists, you know it's the black group. Check it out, you see. The American Association of Anything is white. The National Association of Anything tends to be black. They're all dentists, but a distinction has to be made. Gun control is now has that same schism. So because suburban gun violence, that is to say mass killings, are now prioritized and prioritized by the black president, we now have a new class of violence. And that class of violence requires response. The other class does not. More children, black children, have been killed in the last year, according to the Center for the Violence Policy Center, says that 6,505 black homicide victims were killed in the United States last year. That's more than almost twice as many people who were killed in the World Trade Center attack. This does not constitute an epidemic. It does not constitute a matter of urgency. And therefore, it is not on the map. The media ignores it, and the president ignores it. But here's what the media does. The media relates to gun violence in the black community as a pathological problem, a sociological and pathological problem, so that they can write about it without actually analyzing it. They write about it only to reinforce the prevailing view that black people just are so used to crime and look at what they're doing to each other. It reinforces the negative values that people have and people associate with the black community. If the media were to do the same kind of analytical work as they do with, for example, mass killings. They've gone into mass killings, all kinds of aspects about mental health. And these things, in turn, help in the response to a problem. When they talk about the preponderance of evidence that the people committing these crimes tend to be they seem to be mentally disabled. Don't we now have a national discussion about that? In fact, that's one of the president's executive orders, to study this phenomenon even more so that we could get precisely the kind of help and precisely the kind of intervention in order to address this particular situation. So politics works hand in glove with the media. They both agree on the same thing. The president has created a brand new classification of gun violence by his acts of omission and his acts of commission. He refuses to even pay attention to the epidemic of the black community. His vice president did exactly the same thing. The media saw what I saw and what all America saw with our eyes. But because we are so used to being, you know, the Ralph Ellison character, the invisible man, we are all invisible all over again with a black president. He's not seeing this. And there is a reason. To see the problem for what it is, you now have to ask the appropriate questions, and you now have to take a systemic view, which this president is not equipped to do. He is not a reformer. He talked in his wonderful speech there that we just listened to, that, you know, we have to start all over again, and we could lead, and we, you know, he's not doing any of that. He's not doing any reformation at all. I told you he's a tweaker. He'll turn the knob about 3 degrees to the right, and that's about it. But you will have to take a systemic view, and it will now inform you, again, it will return you to the story of America. It is a story of two different realities. The reality of gun violence in the African American community is different from the reality of the gun violence in Newtown, Connecticut. What is the reality? One community, the middle class community, the upwardly mobile community, is a community that is real. These are a community of real people. They therefore cannot be discarded, even as the perpetrators of a crime. They are to be responded to because they're real people. The African American community is largely a community of throwaways. And in the minds of the political structure, they serve one purpose and one purpose only. That is, you know, show up on election day, give us a vote, and get lost, and then shut up. Other than that, there's no real use for black people. If it weren't for the fact that Barack Obama actually had to depend on the black vote, he would probably not even pay attention to the black community at all. But the community gets no particular special service at all. And this issue is huge. Now, to take a systemic view, you don't have to, when you're looking at Newtown, Connecticut, you know that police are policing. In Chicago, it's a case of law enforcement. In Newtown, there is intervention and resources that are available. In Chicago, there's no such thing. In Newtown and places like Newtown, there is the assumption of accountability for failing to respond. In Chicago, nobody gets punished for not responding. In Newtown, we have a well-ordered society. In Chicago, it's all chaos. Newtown is not a target. In Chicago, the police are part of the criminal element. And if you are to solve the gun problem in Chicago, you will have to, by necessity, put the police department under scrutiny itself, because that's where the guns are coming from. They countenance it. The gun manufacturers will agree, certainly, with people from Newtown. Yes, we will have procedures for licensing and, you know, background checks. That's not the attitude manufacturers have in the black community. It's do whatever you want. Flood the community with whatever they want in the way of guns. I've told you here, I know of cases in New York where the cops were running the gun and prostitution rings and drug rings. They're part of the problem. Now, do you think that anybody wants to undertake a systemic review of the problem? Do you think Joe Biden would want to come back and reveal to the president and to the nation that what he discovered when he actually talked to black people in Chicago was that the problem of gun violence also involves the conduct of police, or the misconduct of police, and the targeting of these communities for all kinds of negative influences, drugs, prostitution, crimes of all types. You'll now have to talk about schools that actually do educate. Like I said, we had the statistics. They didn't even say the unemployment rate in Chicago. They said the employment rate for black children, black teens, or work-age teens in Chicago, the employment rate was 8%. So my little bit of math tells me 92% are not employed gainfully. So when you make these linkages, do you see any extraordinary leap here? That in the absence of a sound education, in the absence of a decent job, in the absence of a decent quality of life, in the absence of a police function that is actually policing as opposed to law enforcement, in the absence of all these things, you really expect that you would not get what we get and what we have? So the gun issue is a parable. It is a metaphor for the politics of race and the internalization, and I'm going on a limb here because I'm acting like a psychiatrist here, but a president that is clearly uncomfortable with the idea of being close to his people. I thought it was quite amusing, considering that he has, you know, just about excoriated his father for being a less than decent man as a father. He talked about him in the speech, which tells you how artificial it is. He didn't name him. He didn't say, "My dad." He said, a village where his father was born. He didn't say it was Africa. He said it was a village where his father was born. That's the kind of new reality that we get. You know, you say things, but you're not saying it. You know, it's on the record that you said something, but when you've examined it, you really haven't said a thing at all. The gun issue is important, and it is so important, it should be the single issue that compels the community to mount an offensive against this president, because he is offensive. This business of deciding that I am not going to see you, I am not going to pay attention to you, you do not exist except as I decree it, that should never be tolerated, not from this president. The problem still stands, and people should move now because the midterm elections are coming up next year. And this is where his interest is. Barack Obama's interest is, of course, to be seen as a man of action, principally to white America. I say that without any hesitation. He is absolutely convinced that there is where his redemption lies. He feels a need to redeem himself to white America, principally. And, you know, the heck with everybody else. You're just going to have to get in line, and, you know, I'll get to you when I can. No, the time has come to play hardball now. Gloves should be off. And we should never accept this kind of insult from this president. You're going to have a national effort that is deliberately excluding the community that's suffering most from it. Then you don't deserve any further courtesies. No further considerations. Second reason that we have to pay attention to is this is his second term and his legacy forming year. The next 4 years would be the legacy forming 4 years. He is the titular head of the Democratic Party, and as such, he means to deliver victory for the party. And that too will come at the expense of the communities that are most hurting. He wants, at the end of it all, to be able to walk away with a majority in the Senate, which he now has, and as a consequence of the elections next year, a majority in the House. What does that do? It makes him practically impervious to challenge. He can get whatever he wants done, and by proxy, of course, because he is an acolyte of the Clintons, he will be able to fulfill their needs even more copiously before he leaves office. So, we start here with the gun issue, and you look at it and you see what's going on. It's not simple. It really isn't. It's a very serious thing. And it is not just, you know, we're not just talking shooting the breeze here. This is how communities systematically are destroyed. And unfortunately, many of the agents of that destruction are people who were created by these very communities, put forward as their leaders, given license to transact business in their name. And instead, I mean, the community isn't asking for anything impossible, but we've gotten nothing. We've gotten nothing in 5 years. I don't see that it makes sense going forward with any particular trust or respect for this president. If I were a black person, I would want to seriously examine my options, my political options. And that is why I had asked you to do as your homework assignment, you look into something called the Opelousas Massacre. OPELOUSAS. The Opelousas Massacre of September the 24th, 1868. I want to stop here for the moment. We are going to get to all of this. I'm not going to take on the Opelousas Massacre today because it really hinges on political choices, and it's a parable associated with political choices. But what is instructive about the Opelousas Massacre is the notion that we never see really very often. We never see the reference to, quote, radical, and that's what they call radical Republicans. Radical Republicans. Amazing. But when we study the Opelousas Massacre, we will see that this was a fight between the Democrats and the Republicans. I'm not talking about a theoretical fight. This was a real fight. A major, major, major fight. Really, over the racist Democratic Party wanting to rout the African Americans who wanted to join the Republican Party and begin to exercise their rights to vote. And the radical Republicans, and this is where the gun story comes in, armed themselves to defend the blacks. And in the end, some close to 300 black people were slaughtered. So when we talk about the right to vote and so forth, and people squandering the vote on the Democratic Party, and we see the Republican Party becoming the offense that it is right now, you begin to understand that when we look at practically any major issue in the United States of America, there is another narrative. And the narrative that the mainstream media puts forward is their story. That's their story. From their perspective, from their point of view, reflecting their interests, their norms, their mores, their world. It's their reality. Just like the gun issue. Their reality is about mass killings. Our reality is a whole different thing. It's a whole different narrative. But they won't tell our narrative. They won't recognize or give any credence to our narrative because our narrative requires the direct attack on systems that they depend on to maintain a supremacist position in the United States. To really grant any legitimacy to our point of view, a person necessarily will have to accept the destruction of his point of view. And we saw that in the discussions with Malcolm X and Jim Farber and Alan Morrison and Wyatt T. Walker. The narrative that they gave about America was not the narrative we normally get. Because most people in power, the power structure, does not recognize that narrative, does not want that narrative, doesn't need it to exist. So a compliant media obeys orders and erases the narrative. It doesn't exist. So you sound like a nut every time you talk about something that you know intuitively. That is, you know, this gun thing, I mean, how we have a whole different narrative. How come that's not happening? People look at you like you're crazy. But in fact, it is a legitimate view. It is a reality. And it falls very much in line with the narrative of America being two separate realities. One black, one white, separate and unequal. I could take a quick call. I've talked. I wanted to get this thing set so that we could move on to it and build on it with this particular point of view. 888-874-4888. I think we have time for a very quick call. And in the meantime, please do, if you haven't had the chance to research it, because we'll be talking about it, because it is very significant, as being one of several mass murders, the attacks on blacks by just incredibly racist whites. But this situation in Louisiana and in the South, we see the Democratic Party for what it is, a racist party. And it's so odd that the tables have turned. We see the Republicans now as right-wingers. And they are. The Republican Party, I'm telling you, the people involved in this thing were called radical Republicans. Radical Republicans. They were white. And they were in the heat of battle against the racist Democrats. Amazing. When you tell people this is what America really was, and they say, this can't be true. This can't have happened. The Republicans are really nice people. Well, you know, it's all politics. Things could, you could be made to remember what you should forget, and you could be made to forget what you should remember. All right, so we have this piece coming up tomorrow, the Opelousas Massacre, and we'll be studying that in conjunction with the narrative of party politics. Okay, we have a quick call from Orville from Brooklyn. Hello, Orville.
Hello, Eutrice.
Hello.
I decided to call. Thank you very much for the program. I appreciate you very much.
Thank you.
In terms of separate and unequal, I think that earlier, when we had a chance, when we were looking for integration, it has not come about. And lots of money was spent in this country on, from many different sides, either to try to stop it or to actually get it to come about. And time and energy and resources. And it's still not here. And I've said for a while that I wish we had just kept separate, but just looked to make it more equal.
Well, I don't know that. I mean, the issue really wasn't for integration. The issue was about desegregation. And it somehow got transmuted into integration.
And when you say integration, desegregation, please, I'm maybe you could school me. What does that mean as to you?
It means that there should be no reason why a child has to get on a bus to go to school to integrate a white school.
Okay, good.
If, you know, there were black schools that were doing very, very well at educating their children.
Yes, very well.
But the resources were not there. The desegregation required that those schools literally not be funded at equal levels or on parity with other schools. So we had there's a big difference between desegregation and integration.
Yes, you know, I think there's an illness into this country that we're not looking to look at that needs to be healed. It needs time for us to heal both black, who have been so wronged, and both white, who has done so much wrong. And they need to heal, and we need to heal. And I think there needs to be a place where we can just be, you know, I think it was, like you said, we had our own schools, and we were doing fine. Of course, the monies and the resources needed to get there to make a better situation, even better.
Sure, sure. Thank you, Orville, for calling.
All right, you too.
Thank you so much. All right, we've come to the end of our program today. I'm happy that you were able to join me. We keep this discussion going because we have to confront this issue with President Obama's decided resistance to his own community. Thank you. We'll see each other again tomorrow at 1 o'clock.